We thought about other people's projects, but we didn't find any interesting ones. So we thought maybe let's just talk about ours. Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories.
Hey everyone, Data Stories number 60. Hey Moritz, how are you?
Hey Enrico, good. How are you?
I'm okay. Summer is almost gone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had some time to restore a little bit. Not too much, but
yeah. At least we took a little Data Stories break, so that horrible part of your life hasn't been bothering you.
Yeah. That was okay too. Yeah.
It's kind of nice. Yeah, I did some traveling too. I had a sort of a turbulent summer with a lot of deadlines, but also vacations, but also projects. And it's sort of confusing. Yeah. A lot of miles in the end. But I had a good August.
Yeah. Me too. I didn't have a real proper vacation, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I've been hiking here and there. I've been visiting a lab in Washington State. It's pretty amazing there.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Nice. Yeah, I had 1 week of camping, like 1 week really off the grid. I didn't even have cell phone reception. So
nice. That's nice. Yeah. And now it's the September craze, right?
Yeah, crunch time again.
That's the hardest, one of the hardest months of the year. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. So, today it's me and you.
Yeah, no special guest. No, the two of us.
Yeah, it's a Moen or Enmo. I think we have done this a few times now, and we just want to talk about, stuff that comes in our mind. Hopefully that's interesting. We have a long list of topics. I don't know if we will manage to cover everything. But I think we want to start with a few updates on Data Stories, which surprisingly we do not very often.
That's true. Yeah.
That's true. We should do it more often. So let me give you a few updates about Data Stories. So the first one is that you might have noticed that we have some sort of a new format that we internally call Project Episodes. So the idea here is that rather than having an episode that is fully focused on one specific topic and one person, we have an episode that is about one specific project. So recently we had one, the last one actually was on the climate change piece from the Bloomberg team. Previously we had an experimental one with Gregor Aish from New York Times on the yield curve. And did we have another one? Another project?
No, I think that's
these are the two ones that we tried. We right now don't have plans to keep doing project episodes with video for a number of reasons, but we do want to continue project episodes because it's fun and because it's a different way. I think it's an interesting way for people to learn more about the specifics of a specific project.
Yeah.
And we do have some more in the pipeline, right, Moritz?
Yeah. At least one that I'm aware of. So if you have any good ideas or any projects where you think like, wow, it could be cool to learn a bit more about the background there and about the design process or the history of a project, let us know. And we can reach out to the people and maybe they will be willing to tell us a bit about the project.
Yes. And related to that, you might or might not have noticed that we have now a sort of new format for the blog post. Now every single episode has an image gallery. So this means that you can go to the blog post and click on the gallery and see images that are related to the episode. Typically, there are screenshots that we take or even photos and pictures. So the idea here is that I mean, we often talk about visual things. So being able to have a preview of the images we talk about is probably useful. This doesn't mean that you cannot listen to the episode without looking at these images, but it's a nice preview if you want to use it.
And we also embed these images when it fits into the podcast itself. So if it depends really a bit on the podcatcher or the application you use to play the podcast, but you might see the images if you're lucky. So I know that on iPhone, some of the players support it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. It's not very well established.
The whole podcasting format, it's all so wonky and all proprietary. And even, you know, Apple, who tried to improve the formats for a while, they are now not supporting their own features anymore. It's very confusing. So, yeah, bear with us there. But we just try to, you know, give you more material as you listen to sort of be able to follow, you know, what we're talking about. I think that's the main motivation there.
Yep. And you now can also join our mailing list or newsletter, whatever you want to call it. And you will be receiving updates directly from us, directly on your inbox. What else, Maurice?
It's basically the blog post, because we had this question if there is exclusive content on the mailing list. I think that's a good idea, though, now that I say it. But yeah. No, but in principle, we just push out the blog post. It's just that also, again, today, it's so unclear how people actually get notified of new stuff. Nobody reads RSS feeds anymore, I guess. And so some people are on Twitter, others have a podcatcher, but this could be a third way of how you can learn about a new episode. Just get an email.
So one last thing I want to say about data stories is that, again, surprisingly, we never mentioned that on the show, but competition has become really high. So if you listen to data stories and you like it, and I'm sure you do, please rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or any related podcast collector. This does actually make a difference. So if you are one of our fans, please spend just a couple of minutes to go to iTunes or similar collections and rate us. That's important. That really makes a difference.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how podcasting took off the last year, right? I mean, we've been there, of course, before the wave. I mean, that's clear. But
let's,
you know,
that.
Now it sort of takes off. And there's like a whole lot of platforms. Like, I just got an email from podcasts.com, never heard of them before, but they have a big podcast directory. They're Stitcher, they've been around for a while, but there were two or three other podcasting platforms and lots of also data-related podcasts, you know, emerging. And it's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool, yeah. Do you listen to any of them?
Yeah, I listen more to not so tech data-related stuff because I need a break, you know, at some point. It's like... So, but I'm aware of a couple of them, and I listened into a few of them, like the Talking Machines one. I didn't really follow up on that. It's probably too specific for me or too technical, maybe. I occasionally listen to our most direct competitor, John Schwabisch, with his Policy Risk podcast.
Yep.
He has very similar guests, and you know, but also a few different ones. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
He's also on Rad Presenters, right?
He does Rad Presenters, but also the Policy Viz podcast. And I think if you like data stories, he will like these two. I would guess. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And you said you really enjoy Data Skeptic, right?
Yeah. So out of all those new podcasts related to data, I have to say that Data Skeptic is the one that, I don't know,
cool.
I enjoyed the most so far. Yeah. I really like the way Kyle introduces a lot of different topics, and he has kind of like a different couple of formats, the same way we do. He has regular interviews, but also mini episodes explaining the basics of some data science topics. Uh-huh. And it's just brief, very brief episodes, but very informative and fun. And one thing that I'm really jealous about is doing that with his wife, who is nice. Actually not a data expert.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I really like the format. So if you guys are interested in more data podcasts, I strongly suggest you to.
I mean, the two of us are like an old couple, so. You know.
Yes.
Same thing here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're gonna put a link on the blog post. There is so recently I have seen quite a few list of best data science related podcasts. There is a nice one on called the 7 Best Data Science and Machine Learning Podcasts. So if you are curious about that, there are quite a few ones mentioned there, including Data Stories, of course.
I just wanted to ask, like, which position are we in?
Oh. It's not a rank.
Number 5. Yeah, but they have data skeptic linear regressions I heard of, never listened into, partially derivative or really data show. Yeah, so I think that's a good list. Cool.
Yeah, it's a good list. Yeah, very absolutely. Nice. I am totally sure we will see more in the future. That's growing so fast. It's actually amazing to have a podcast in at this time, actually. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's the return of talk radio in a way. It's really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a great medium. And I mean, for me personally, I spent all day, you know, typing and reading and looking, and it's so relaxing to just listen. That's just me.
Maybe, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. It's the same for me. Yeah. It's a great format.
And we have another great thing coming up.
Yep.
People say we have the perfect faces for radio, but if you're in New York, you can also inspect our faces in real life, IRL, because I'll be in New York beginning of November for Visualized Conference.
Yep.
Great conference. I was there last year already, and it's 2 days, really packed 2 days. It's short talks, 15 to 20 minutes, and really excellent people. Good conference. And we have the opportunity to do a Data Stories meetup as sort of a satellite event to the conference. It's kind of cool.
That's great. I think you said first days of November, but I think it's first days of October. Yeah,
it's totally wrong.
So it's first days of October.
Yeah. And the meetup is on Wednesday, October 7th.
Yep. So if you
downtown
are in New York,
Manhattan,
or plan to be in New York, come sign up.
Yeah, it's only $5.
Yep,
it's a fair price in my view. Yeah, it's basically just to make sure that everybody who signs up actually shows up. We still don't know what we do there, so we will be around. Some of you will be around. Then we need to figure out what we do. So we have some ideas, but if you have ideas, or if you have, you can also think about questions you want to ask us, or, you know, we can talk about like past episodes or future episodes or data related stuff, of course. So yeah, let us know if you have any ideas because we need to figure something out.
We do have some crazy ideas, but
but there might be crazier ones around.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways, could be good. We did this once at Viz conference. It was just nice to see like the listeners and what they, you know, it was good to hear like what they enjoy, what they don't enjoy, you know, how they came to listen to the show. For us, it makes it much more graspable, right? It's like,
absolutely.
We're just talking into the void here. And then somebody writes something on Twitter, you know, something like this. But we never have this direct contact with the listeners. And it's just nice. It's a bit awkward, obviously, but also nice. Actually meet in real life.
I agree. Seeing some faces is a good thing.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, it's hard to realize that listeners are actually out there. They're real people. We can actually
people,
talk to.
With hands, people. Legs, so, everything. Yeah. No, and for us, it's good feedback. So if you can come up, talk to us, and I'm sure it will be entertaining and informative 2 hours. It's at least how they announced it. So we'll see if we can live up to that.
Yep.
Relatedly, we also have Ask Us Anything session coming up on Reddit. So you might have seen there's a few people like the Data is Beautiful subreddit, which is a great place for Dataverse anyways. And they have this new series of Ask Me Anythings, AMAs. There was, who was there? Robert Kazara, Mike Bostock.
Tamara Manciner.
Tamara did one. So basically Data Stories crowd anyways, as you can see. Santiago will do one next week.
Santiago, yeah. Yeah.
And we will do one in November. So if you have any like smart questions you want to ask us.
Or even dumb ones.
Or dumb ones or tricky ones. Like, yeah. Whatever you can come up with. So you have 2 months to now formulate them in a nice way. And then we will be there to answer them.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I guess I too. I'm not sure. I never did it. I think it could be super stressful to do these things. You have to type a lot in short time, right? It's like...
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's a new format. Again, I'm so fascinated by
this. I just hope I don't get into another internet fight. I have a tendency to get involved into these endless debates. Oh, man. Yeah. You need to make sure I don't get caught up in something.
Yeah.
Call the Reddit police. Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah. I'll just unplug my internet in case it gets too bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So shall we talk more about some of our recent projects?
Yeah, we thought about other people's projects, but we didn't find any interesting ones. So we thought maybe let's just talk about ours. They are pretty good. No, but...
That's terrible. Okay, say it again.
Yeah, I'm a bad person. Didn't you know that? No, just being sarcastic. No, but I mean, for me, actually, it was a very busy year. And I wrapped up a few things before like summer. And then I went into vacations. And then now suddenly all these websites pop up and get launched. And, you know, so it's kind of cool. It's, you know, you come back from vacations and all your stuff is online. That's kind of nice. As long as the clients don't send you emails during vacations, which some of them did. But
Of course.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can talk about a few projects. Shall I make a start? We can take turns, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the first one is still sort of in the making, but I want to nevertheless talk about it. It's kind of interesting. So it's called False Positive. And I'm doing that together with Mark Shepherd, who initiated the whole project, and Julian Oliver. They're both artists and scholars, but mostly artists. And yeah, it's a complex project. It's actually kind of hard to explain, but it deals with corporate profiling and how companies deal with data and control over networks and infrastructure and so on. And these are all topics that the three of us are pretty concerned with and interested in. And so, we're doing this art collaboration around it. It's a whole series of events. Like, it will be exhibited at 4 more places. It has been shown at Ars Electronica already, and then it tours sort of through Europe in the fall. And basically what we do is we pretend there's a new telecommunications provider called Candygram, which is like a really good name, I think. And Candygram is sort of an odd company. It's a bit strange, simply. It's it's never quite clear what to think of it. And the people who interact with Candygram at some point realize that, Candygram keeps asking you for your email address to sign up for something or to make a consultation or, you know, to get a service. And basically what we do is, as soon as people provide their email address, is create data profiles on them. So we search on the web, what can we learn about this person in automatic ways? Like scrape all the text of web pages where they appear and scrape their social media profiles and so on. And so basically people learn at some point that Candygram knows quite a bit about them. Yeah. And that sort of bleeds through all the communications with the company, and it sort of peaks in a data consultation. So you can book a date with one of the sales agents. And then they show you basically what Candygram has on you. And it's like a series of slides, like a little slideshow with words that are associated to you, other people that might be similar or you might know. And the most like shocking thing is always a personality profile. So I'm calculating this personality profile along 5 different traits or 5 different dimensions, the big 5, that's sort of a standard in psychology. And then everybody gets their data profile, personality guess, more or less. And I won't disclose too much, but I can also say the databases for this is highly speculative. So it's, you know, basically what people see, half of it is more or less made up or loose speculation association, but the other half is quite accurate. And that sort of, you know, puts it into this interesting space where you don't really know what's going on and you don't really know what's happening. And yeah, sometimes it's a bit hit and miss. These things are always a bit hit and miss, but sure, for all of the people, it has always been a bit like there was always one spooky moment for them. Like, wow, how did you know that? Or, you know, like, how does the internet know I'm such a nervous person? You know, I try to pretend to be normal or something like this. And the interesting question is, of course, like when companies profile us, and they do, well, what if they are right? Like, that's always the big fear, of course, that Google knows everything about us or things like this. But I think the much bigger problem is, what if they are wrong? You know, what if you, you know, get miscategorized because somebody has the same name as you or used your email address in, you know, fraudulent activity, or there's just a typo in the database, and then you land in a category where you don't belong, and suddenly you have big problems, you know? And I think these are very real, like, concerns or scenarios, and we are playing a bit with that. And try people to help also to, you know, to understand how these things work, and then in the end show them a few ways of how they can maybe protect themselves or be smarter about their data leaks, their personal data leaks. Yeah,
absolutely. That's a great project, I think. Such a timely project, because things are changing very fast, much faster than we can understand, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's not just a matter of, I'm wondering if you've been thinking about it, it's not just a matter of what companies can do with this data, which of course is a big concern, but also criminals. I think there is a big concern on what criminals can do with your data and how easy it is to access your data. So I remember reading...
Also identity theft and so on.
Yeah,
so you can buy people's profiles for like low amounts of, like, you know, in the dozens of dollars, you can buy somebody's all their online info, basically. Pretend you're them.
I mean, I remember reading some months ago this book called Future Crimes. And there is this interesting stories about a journalist who've been stolen a lot of information. And when they describe how this happened, it's crazy easy. I mean, me and you could have done it very easily, right? So that's quite scary. Even scarier, realizing that me, that I have a background in computer science, and I mean, I have a little bit of knowledge, right? And still, I was surprised by the kind of information I read there, and what is possible today. So I find it really interesting that you're not trying to be super accurate. So are you trying to increase awareness? So what is the main goal of the project?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, it's an art project. So we want to leave the audience slightly puzzled and, you know, not be totally clear about what everybody wants to achieve. Because it's much more interesting if this happens somewhere else, like not in our concrete like statements. We want to, and also the project is deployed at places where there's, let's say, normal people around. So the next one will be in a shop, really. Like, there's also talk of a shopping mall that where we might have a booth. So, and also at Ars Electronica, we had very, like, a whole mix of people.
Yeah.
And for them, these topics are always, like, somehow in the news, and you hear about Snowden, and you hear about Amazon, and you hear about Google, but it's very abstract.
When it
actually becomes about you and you see sort of a bit of the workings, and also when it breaks and the underlying mechanisms, I think that's quite instructional and quite interesting. I mean, the problem is the personal data consultation as we do them, they are super intense, and Mark did such a great job of delivering them. He was like really the data doctor, you know, in a way. But that doesn't scale. And so now we're thinking about ways how we can achieve the same effects in a different way for a broader range of people. But it's an ongoing sort of investigation.
That's nice. Can you disclose any of the mechanisms that you have behind the scenes?
Yeah, just I will definitely write a technical blog post. It's a lot of Python. I use a service called Full Contact. It's actually quite pricey, but what it does really well is resolve an email address to all the social media profiles that are associated with that email address. And that's hard work. It's possible, but it's really hard work. So I'm happy to pay for that. And it also gives you things like hometown and gender and estimated age of the person, things like this. And so then once I have the seeds data set, I do a bit of text analysis, a bit of, machine learning things and come up with these profiles. And then it's only web technologies in the front end, like Reveal.js to have like a slideshow of different like HTML based contents and React.js, D3. So it's a wild mix of existing libraries as usual. But I'll do a write up on that. That has been a journey in itself, and it's not quite finished yet because it's hard to do something really. That's the other thing. It's really hard to do something that does automatic stuff just based on public information and your email address.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing is, people assume, well, it's so easy to find out anything anyways. Everything's on Facebook, but Facebook doesn't give it to you, you know?
Yeah,
and so, it's actually kind of difficult to actually achieve that big reveal, you know, that people expect in that situation. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So,
Nice.
Yeah, interesting project. Cost me a lot of nerves and everybody involved, but it's been quite rewarding too. So,
some of the best projects are like this.
And it's so like speculative, and we wanted to do a lot with like actual network infrastructure and cell towers and so on. But base stations, cell phone base stations, and so on. But these things are hard. I mean. Yeah. It's waves, not particles.
Absolutely.
Waves are tricky, and also telecommunications technology is tricky. And so, all of that has been hard, but a good project. Yeah.
Nice.
This is a great time to take a little break and talk about our sponsor this week. Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories. And you know, last time I told you a bit about Qlik Sense 2.0, the new features that it brings, also how Qlik was named a top 10 innovative growth company by Forbes. This time I'd like to tell you a bit about three blog posts on the Qlik blog that I found really interesting. They're from visualization advocate Patrick Lundblad, and he covers really the basics of data visualization really well in these three posts. So the first one is on data attributes. What types of data could we have? How are they different? What makes them special? The second part covers which visual encoding can we then choose for these data types? Which types of graphical variables can we use to express information? And the third part is about, well, what do you actually want to show? Like, what's the purpose of your chart? And which chart type do you pick accordingly? And I think these three blog posts, they present really nicely the foundations of data visualization. I think it's great that Qlik takes care of also educating the users a bit on what makes a good chart and how to best use data visualization. And they continue to do so. So if you want to try out their new product, Qlik Sense 2.0, give it a try at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories. And now back to the show. How about you? You've been involved in a few things too, huh?
Yes. So one of the things I want to talk about is a project that we have an ongoing project that we have in collaboration with ProPublica here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
ProPublica is a newsroom. They do investigative journalism. We actually had Scott Klein on the show some time ago.
Right.
So our listeners should know something about ProPublica. They do a lot of investigative journalism, and then they publish interesting internet applications and infographics and visualizations. So it's really interesting what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we started doing together is to look into very large sets of Yelp reviews, mainly on the data feed they produce on the healthcare. So this includes typically doctors, nurses, and hospitals, and so on. So anything.
So did you filter it for that, like from the start? Like
Yelp gives us directly only this kind of feed.
Ah,
they have different categories, and they and they provide only this category to us.
Got it.
But that's what we are interested in. That's what ProPublica is interested in. And I think historically they've been working a lot on anything related to medical. Mm-hmm. So I think they have an application where you can see how much money your doctor takes from pharmaceutical companies. You can literally type your doctor's name and you get a full list of...
That's kind of interesting. Yeah.
And recently they published another piece on, I think, quality of surgeons and how many mistakes surgeons make.
So, that's good to know, too.
If you are planning some surgery, you'd better check the name of your doctor there.
But if your surgeon has only 3.5 stars on Yelp, you might reconsider.
It's not as simple as this. And this is where I believe one of the reasons why this project is interesting, because what we are doing is to build... interactive user interfaces for them to look into this very large set of reviews. Mm-hmm. So right now we have almost 1.5 millions of reviews, only considering the healthcare data. So one of the first steps, we developed this tool that we call Revex, and which stands for Review Explorer.
Pretty much.
Guess what?
And scientists and names. It's
we're not the best with that. But we have this initial interface where you can basically the main idea is to have an interface through which they can very quickly create data queries, that they want to single out reviews with special combination of parameters, right? So for instance, reviews that contain the name of a specific drug and have one star, and then you can see the distribution across other dimensions, like who are the providers, in what category, and so on. And then there, for every single search, you have a summary of the results through some tag clouds, and then you can see the documents, basically.
So it's a faceted search.
It's basically a faceted search kind of tool.
Yeah.
And it's nothing too innovative, but it's really useful. And we are very much interested in understanding how people use these kind of tools to derive new insights and knowledge.
And it's amazingly fast. I was really blown away because it's millions of reviews. And you have a demo with a million reviews on the website.
Yeah.
And everything it's there, you know, you click, there. Yeah. It's kind of amazing. Yeah,
this is thanks to one of my students. His name is Christian Felix da Silva. Uh-huh. He's an amazing programmer. Plus, he has a very nice aesthetic sense, which honestly is pretty rare in computer science students.
Right. Yeah.
So, he's amazing. And
and how did you build the backend, like the search indexing?
He used Elasticsearch. And the rest is just... D3, JavaScript, and AngularJS. As I said, I mean, it's a simple tool, but it's really, really powerful. And what is really interesting from my point of view is understanding how these tools help people derive new knowledge and insights.
Right.
And I mean, honestly, at least from the point of view of an academic like me, it's stunning to see people using this tool. They literally use this tool to search for specific doctors and they call them, right? So they have the tool in front of them. They spot a doctor, they search for the number and call the doctor.
They had surgery last week. Tell me more about it.
I mean, that's pretty amazing, right? Let's talk about actionable tools. That's amazing for me. I mean, being able to work on something that is so actionable is something really, really rewarding from my point of view.
Nice.
And, so they already published one article thanks to the things that they found through the using the tool.
Right.
So if you go to the link that I will put on the blog post to the Revex page, you can see you have an overview of the interface. There is a video showing the interface, how it works when you interact with it. There is also a little demo that is based on public data that Yelp published online. So this is not the data that actually the folks at ProPublica use, but you can get a sense of how the tool works. And another very interesting thing, there is a, as I was saying, there is an article that they published on NPR. It's called On Yelp, Doctors Get Reviewed Like Restaurants, and it rankles. And I think this is what, I mean, if you're interested in the topic, I suggest you to read the article, because it gives you a sense of how complex this space of review analysis is. It's not just spotting bad doctors and assuming that they are really bad. There is a whole interplay between what doctors need and what patients need, what are expectations of both sides. Yeah, I think that it's a very interesting space where a lot of different things are happening, and it's very interesting, right? Because you can... So let me just tell you one thing. Do you want your doctor to be... to please you or to cure you, right? Mm. So here there is a really interesting problem, because in a way, you can clearly see that people give good reviews to doctors that take care of things that are not necessarily highly related to your health. Right. It is you can very clearly make an example of a doctor who is doing something that is not pleasing to you, but it's the right thing to do at that time. Mm. Right.
Mm. Many, let's say, alternative medicine, you know, successes are I think partly just due to that people get attention and somebody actually listens to them, and you know, that makes them feel better already. And that, you know, and this is what they don't get at the normal medical doctor, which is bad. So, you know, these doctors should learn from that. But at the same time,
And of course, you spot really bad doctors, right? Some of them are really bad, and you can spot them using the tool, which is scary. Right. But I think it's an interesting space where the interplay between, physicians, doctors, and patients, and how the relationship is changing thanks to these new tools. It's very interesting. It's a world that is changing a lot thanks to tools like Yelp and other related review systems.
It's an interesting question what effect that has, like all this online reviewing. And I mean, we can see how it changes the restaurant scene for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, if it goes to doctors and every type of service you get, it's if everything is a chase for the five stars review, you know, it's...
Exactly.
That can be problematic too.
It can be problematic. Right. But at the same time, you can argue that it's really good that you can see reviews. Right. I mean, it's much more freedom, much more democracy. Yeah.
When I was looking for a doctor, I posted on a local group on Facebook and just got 10 different opinions. But, you know, five of them agreed that like one doctor is pretty good. And I was like, let's try this one out. And he's pretty good. You know, so. Wisdom of the crowds. Very nice. Yeah. And will you do like a case study paper on like how people use it, or how do you track like how ProPublica uses it, or how do you document that?
So right now we have something that should be a little paper that should come out sometime in October in how is it called? Computational Journalism Conference. But this is just an initial step. This is more like telling the story of what happened and how the tool works.
Yeah.
But I think one of the ideas that we have in mind, we have two ideas. One is, as I was saying at the beginning, using this tool as a way to better understand how people discover information with this kind of data interfaces. Mm-hmm. And another one, of course, is that the more we work with this kind of people, the more we uncover new needs that are not covered by existing tools, right? So it's more like a probe to uncover interesting problems, right?
Yeah. And if journalists can actually develop new types of stories based on these tools. And
so. Exactly.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Good stuff. It seems like you're actually doing something useful. That's
that's my biggest achievement of 2015. I did something useful.
Somebody used it. Yeah. Because you never know. And if you actually somebody like, you know, like using your interface for real, I think that's great.
Me say that on a more serious note, I think this is really important for visualization in general, right? I mean, we have amazing examples of people who have done super useful visualization, made super useful visualization tools. Like, I don't know, I think about D3, of course, is a clear example, or I don't know, other libraries or tools. But sure. In general, I think thinking about usefulness in visualization is an important topic. And it's not just usefulness, right? Anything related to data.
Sure.
Right. So, yeah.
Yep.
So what is next on your side?
A couple of things coming up. I have one more project I just finished I wanted to talk about. Inclusive Growth Report for the World Economic Forum. Challenging project, but very interesting. And I had the chance to work with Stephanie Pozavec on that, also on the show. Yeah. So it's the first time we did a design project together, and it went really well. So, you know, you never know. It's like, are we compatible or not? The approaches, but it was great fun.
It's like new couples, yeah.
Yeah, sure. it was great fun and very productive and, super cool. But the funniest thing is, like, the outcome is actually like what you would exactly expect if you put me and Stephanie in a room. Super, like, organic, nice colors, but also, like, slightly geometric. So cliche. And actually, we tried different things, but somehow now it's again like a leaf of a tree, and it's like super organic. Well, what can you do? But it works really well, and it's a cool project. So you can check out the website. I'll give it a link. And the scorecards are the most interesting part, I think. So each country has a scorecard, like Germany and so on, and you can see how each country performs. And these are pretty tight and neat. And thanks to Stephanie also for the great work there. And I learned a lot of technical stuff on that project because I was working also with Nine Elements, great company.
Yep.
Good people. And Matthias, the coder there, he set up this super crazy, crazy framework. And I think I've seen the future. I mean, we'll see how it plays out. But for me, it was like really a revelation in terms of how you can organize a web project and how to set everything up. And well, basically we used ES6, which is ECMAScript 6, which is the successor of JavaScript. Like, it's a more sane version of JavaScript. The people who used ActionScript 3 will recognize a lot of stuff. It's actually kind of similar, which is fun. And this helps a lot with organizing your code in a good way and having a really concise code. And it plays really well. We used Babel, and that plays really well with React.js. React.js is a framework from Facebook, which has become hugely popular over the last year. And these two things play together really well. And everything was split up into individual modules, and also the CSS code that corresponded to a user interface element was bundled together with that. So you have very little dependencies. Everything's very like neatly packaged and immediately accessible. I was very impressed. So it's great to work like that. And so I'm transitioning now to ES6. Mm-hmm. And I can really recommend that to everybody who's frustrated with JavaScript, as you should be. And you get to think in new ways. So you think much more in terms of mix-ins and modules rather than inheritance and big frameworks. It's much more like little parts neatly combined. And I like that style anyways. And now I'm working on two projects with Pixie.js. And Pixie.js, Dominicus, another guest, like, you know, it's the old Data Stories crowd, obviously. He pointed me to that, and he used it for this year's Better Life Index for the OECD. And it's a really nice rendering framework where you write code, again, very similar to Flash. This is probably why I like it so much. So you write like an abstract scene graph description of how your graphic should look like and behave. And it can be rendered in WebGL, which is super fast, or Canvas, which is available anywhere else. And so you have a nice platform independent way of doing super high performance graphics. And I'm just working now on a spinny globe thing with more than 4,000 data points on particles, and everything's being projected and drawn in real time. And it's like basically at 60 FPS. So I'm happy.
Nice.
So, and these things, they make everything that I did like half a year ago look really old. And it's like, you know, web development is so crazy. It's like every three months, I basically throw away all my stuff and start from scratch. Yeah,
it's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, technology is changing so freaking fast.
Yeah. But yeah, ES6 and React are definitely here to stay. Also, if you say Angular, forget Angular. Learn React if you have a chance, and ES6, and you should be safe for at least 9 months, I would say.
So do you have any kind of like internal rule on when, how to adapt some new technology? I mean, you work with this all the time, right? I'm sure you are exposed to a lot of new libraries and ways to implement stuff. How do you decide when to switch? Because of course there is always some cost associated to switching, right?
It's hard. I mean, I think with all these things, the community is the most important thing. So however the website looks like, just look who's behind that, like who's behind the projects. Are these people who have been around for a while and who are really serious about this stuff? Mm-hmm. Because many, many projects on GitHub end at a 90% completion state, more or less, and you know, nobody takes care of the rest. And you need to make sure you don't put all your money on one of those projects. So I'd give it some time and see if there's like a solid community around the tool. But you can be wrong. Like a lot of people thought Angular is a great idea and then got super frustrated in projects. And React basically was, React and Angular were like equal competitors for a while. And now it's so clear. Yeah, React has sort of made that race. I don't try to be the very early wave, but be second wave. Maybe 3 months behind the curve. And then you at least avoid the very bad mistakes.
It's a wild, wild world.
But it's tough. And I spend a few days often like refactoring something or like rewriting something to fit a new framework. And then you realize it's crap. That's super frustrating. But I mean, what can you do?
Yeah. So can you tell us more about the project itself, about Excellence Networks?
The inclusive growth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those reports. So I do a lot of these reports type things where you have countries and you learn something about those countries. It's like a default project category. But this one's quite nice. So it's about inclusive growth. So it means like how the economic growth in a country, how does it like really fit for everybody in a country, or do just little, you know, small amount of people profit from economic growth? Mm-hmm. So it's about equality and inclusiveness and so on. And the team measured like loads of data, really. It's hundreds of indicators that are aggregated into different categories, super much data. And the problem is sort of we don't really provide a really high-level ranking or a big picture view because it's sort of hard to come up with a definite single ranking, right? And so we focus more on the individual country views, and you can compare your country to your peer countries and things like this. But it's, I mean, that's sometimes a problem with these types of projects, is it's hard to make definite statements. Who's best or who's worst? You know what you would like to see maybe from a design point of view, but it's just from a political point of view, not adequate to do these types of things.
Sure.
Yeah, but I think we did a great job on that. So.
So are you working on any other similar kind of project?
In some way always, but right now I have a little break from these types of activities. So I have two projects I'm really excited about. One is a wind forecast project. It's gonna take a while until it comes out. I'm pretty far already, but the data side needs to be there as well, and but that's cool. It's like with real climate scientists making wind predictions. It's a lot about visualizing uncertainty and finding good visual models for wind predictions. So that's super fun. And I'm really excited about that. And the second one is a big ambient visualization for a company that does cybersecurity. So I visualize all the hosts they're running and the attacks they are being, you know, who's attacking who, how much, and so on. And so there's loads of stuff I can play with, and they want something really cool too. So I think these two projects, they're going to keep me busy for the fall pretty much. Yeah. How about you? What are you up to?
So another thing I want to briefly talk about is that we just started a new project on human rights visualization. That's really nice. We got some funding from MacArthur Foundation. Thanks, okay. MacArthur Foundation. I'm really excited because this is in collaboration with a couple of colleagues from NYU, and especially with Meg Satterwhite from NYU Law and Odette Nov from my same school, Polytechnic School. And it's something we've been working together for quite a while, but now we have a project funded and a lot of new practical ideas and ways to make progress in this area. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really, really interesting. And again, this is another space where I believe we can have a lot of impact beyond doing exclusively academic work. So here is a nice project where I believe we can do both interesting academic work and at the same time having practical impact. And it's really interesting because human rights traditionally is a subject or an area where people didn't really work with quantitative data, right? It's mostly about reading and writing and reading long reports, lots of qualitative data, and performed by lawyers, right? I don't want to say anything against lawyers, but I think they're not traditionally they're not quantitative people. But of course, this is changing as every other area in the world is changing, and we are moving towards a lot more data, a lot more quantitative data. But human rights has very specific problems there. So one common problem, for instance, is that data is incomplete, right? It's almost always incomplete. And they have lots of interesting rules. Human rights organizations have very interesting rules on what to show, what not to show, and how to show it, right? And this is developing all the time. And it's a very, very interesting space and very unique problems there. So I don't know, for instance, showing a number of murders in a specific regions on a map is problematic because you might very well just, quote unquote, just represent the way data has been sampled, right? And most of the time it's like that. That's the only thing that you are showing, right?
Now, the first thing is always you show primarily population density, like where do people live?
Yeah, that's another thing, right?
So that's the first thing that goes wrong. And the second then is, what do we measure actually where? And that's also the same problem with these types of inclusive growth projects and so on. Is like where it matters the most, like, you know, in Africa and Asia and so on, you know, it's really hard to get reliable numbers because a lot of the data is self-reported.
Exactly. It's problematic. But at the same time, human rights people feel like there is there are a lot of opportunities there to do amazing things with visualization, right? And so it's a
so
very interesting
space.
What
do you visualize? Can you tell us a bit more, or is it still
I can briefly mention. So I cannot tell too much about what we are currently doing, but we are working on satellite images, which is a total new space for me. I think I never ever worked on images before.
It's very interesting.
And this made me think about what is visualization. Is satellite images visualization? I guess so. It is, right? But it's also a picture. I mean, an image, right? So it's this very interesting space where it's not something that is totally abstract, but it's not very concrete as well.
No,
it's
scientific imaging in a way, like microscope images or large hadron collider measurements. And I agree, it's a very interesting space, like where you use images as sensors, more or less, or like sensor output,
But I think in a way, this is even more interesting because scientific images are most of the time used only by scientists, right? But in human rights, these images are used not only for internal analysis, but also to communicate information to the to the large public, right?
Or and to prove something or to show not, the effect of something. And
It's not rare to see these kind of images in a newspaper or magazine, right?
Right.
And of course, there is also an emotional component there. So it's a very, very interesting space. And as I said, it's totally new to me. I've never worked on images before. And I find it really, really, really interesting.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing right now. And I just want to briefly mention that we have a new paper out from my lab about the climate work that we have done in the past with a group of climate scientists. This is a project that we've been working on for a little bit more than 2 years. And that's the last paper we published on the topic. I want to briefly mention it because I think it's one of those academic works that can have some interesting implications on how people do visualization in practice. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been mentioning part of this work before on the show, but very briefly, the idea here is to come up with kind of like visualization guidelines by analyzing a large set of examples coming from a specific discipline. So in this case, we've been analyzing a large set of visualizations produced by climate scientists for their publications and talks as well. Mm-hmm. And we create a sort of taxonomy of issues, right? Visualization design issues. I think one thing that I really like about this project is that we didn't just stop the moment we created this taxonomy. We also spent quite a lot of time going back to the climate scientists and showing what we have done and created what we call matches and mismatches,
right?
Which is mostly about what does a data visualization expert believe is correct and what does a climate scientist believe is correct. Where does our opinion match, right? And doesn't match. And I find this part really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see much more of that, right? So in a way, this study is very narrow. It's a group of, 20 climate scientists, so a specific kind of climate scientist, somewhat, in a way, even if it's a lot of images, it's still a very small set compared to what people produce around the world, right? But I would love to see more of this kind of research because it really gives a sense of not only what are the problems out there, the design problems out there, but also how different communities see different problems, right? And you can see that when there are these kind of Twitter battles discussing about what is correct and what is not correct, you totally get a sense and a flavor of what how many different opinions are out there, right? Mm-hmm. But I think especially in the world of science, we need to discuss this much, much more. And I think there is a lot to gain for science and scientists in communicating with data visualization experts and designers, just to better understand how to communicate science to others, not just to their peers, right?
Right.
And I think
I think for both, use cases, there can be a lot. There's a lot to be done. Nice. I think that's a great, great study. I'm just flipping through it and I think it's a super interesting topic, and I also agree sometimes we tend to be a bit cocky in a sense that we think just because we know visual variables and we have read Cleveland, we can suddenly like be experts on anything. And So it's good, this reality check that, you know, some plots might make sense after you are exposed to them for a decade.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I am afraid of this kind of this gospel that we try to... Right. I mean, of course, to some extent, you do need, I don't know, some systematic analysis and even prediction of what
you know,
work,
with some best practices, you can improve a lot on all the standard graphics.
Yeah.
Like, I see the spaghetti plot, like it has 10 different lines, color-coded. Yeah. They all overlap. It's something where visualization expert says, yeah, that doesn't really work. Let's make small multiples. You make small multiples to the right of that. Yeah. Immediately, everybody says, like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That totally works. Like, why don't we do it like that, right?
Yeah.
But there might also be other cases where, something seems obscure or sort of strange, but then it does make sense if you know a bit about the data and about the conventions in the domain and so on.
We had a lot of interesting discussions on the rainbow color map with them,
which is
of course pervasive in climate science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. It's not that black and white as some people want us to believe.
I have my opinions.
maybe we should have a show.
But if it's not at least perceptually corrected, I'm not on board. I'm sorry.
I agree. That's not what I'm saying, but I think it's the story is more complicated than that.
Could be. Yeah. Nice. That sounds good.
Yep.
Maybe we should have a climate scientist on board at some point. Yeah.
Well, we had the Bloomberg episode. That was fun.
Yeah. And we were also both part of workshops. Yeah. So we could have Greg on the show.
Yeah. Climate is a very interesting area. Yeah.
Yeah. And important.
Very important. Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Any other projects? Any upcoming things? Anything interesting?
So from my point of view, one last thing I want to mention is that I am going to start my new InfoVis course next week on Monday.
Uh-huh.
I am, as usual, excited and nervous at the same time. It's interesting how much of a struggle there is every year trying to come up with the right balance between things. And
will you ever do a MOOC where we all can take part and do your exercises? That's what I'm interested in.
I hope so. Yeah, we do have actually an online internal course that I recorded last year.
Cool.
But that's not freely available.
Huh.
But honestly, to tell you the truth, I believe that I'm still improving a lot. I'm never too happy about my courses.
You're not ready yet?
I'm not ready yet because I'm still experimenting with a lot of things.
Yeah, it's
especially fun. The right balance between, let's call it, theory and practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard. It's very hard to find the right balance. At least for me, I don't know. I mean, maybe for others it's not.
No, but it's the ongoing thing in DataWiz courses, sure. Like, how much do you try out? How much background knowledge do you need? Like, before, after, like, yeah.
I mean, every year, my towards the end of the course, I feel like I spend too much time giving lectures, and students, I can literally see them learning much, much quicker when I sit next to them and criticize their work.
Yeah.
So
maybe you should just start with projects and then demonstrate everything on the concrete example. Like, if somebody uses like a funny color map, bring it up on the projector and say like...
Maybe.
Yeah, what can we do here? Like, do you see alternatives, or what do you think would be the textbook solution for this? Things like this.
Yeah. I think Tamara Matzner has an interesting solution to that. She basically splits her course in two halves.
Uh-huh.
First half is the whole set of theory going through her book, and second half is project, basically.
But it's first theory, then practice.
Yeah. First theory, then practice. I think it's an interesting format.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you guys have any suggestions, let me know. That's an ongoing struggle for me.
Yeah. I'll ask you again in 3 months.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. How about you? Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
Not really. I'll be teaching a few workshops too, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
That's more internal, but yeah. So I'll face the same problems too. Yeah, I have a bit of conferences coming up. So if you are in Belgium, you could go to KIK Festival.
Nice. What is that?
It's in November and it's pretty cool. It's a big festival and I think it's basically free or very low attendance fee because it's basically financed by cultural money. So, or it's like regional development funds, basically. And it's a huge digital like festival, really interesting stuff, great speakers, conference, exhibition space and so on. So
nice.
That's worth checking out. Yeah, that's early November. And mid-November, I'm in Katowice in Poland for the Art Bits Festival. And that's going to be good too. And yeah, I'm a huge like fan of what's going on in Eastern Europe. And I'm always super interested. And these guys, they make a really good impression. They have like a media lab there that deals a lot with urban data and smart city type things. And also the conference here, they have Lev Manovic, who I've been working with, as you know, Stephanie Posavec, who I've been working with, as you know, Niklas Roy, who is a super fun guy, super flux, great people from design fiction area, Dietmar Offenhuber, who we had on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And Studio Nant. And we also had Stefan on this show. So again, it's a Data Stories crew party, basically. Yeah. But mid-November in Poland. Yeah.
Nice.
If you happen to be around, say hi.
I would love to.
Drop by, say hi.
Yeah.
What's coming up for you? Viz, probably.
Well, Viz
as every
is the
year.
Usual every year.
Yeah.
So Viz is... Viz 15 is in Chicago this time.
Chicago's not bad. Yeah.
And... if you haven't seen it yet, there is the whole set of papers online. Mm. I think they also published video previews.
But the videos, but the papers are not yet, no?
I think at least the titles and authors are out there. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure they're going to post some...
You don't usually read more than the title or what?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's getting bigger and bigger, so you cannot actually read everything, right?
Yeah.
But you can get a sense
but you
of
know who,
the
who
main trends. And it's interesting. I think almost every year you can see some main trends.
What's your guess? What's going to be big this year?
I'm not sure yet. I'll tell you later.
After the conference.
After the conference, I think. Let me think.
Applied stuff?
I'm not sure. I didn't read
more
carefully
theory?
Yet.
Yeah. Frameworks?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to talk about it in one of our later shows. I'm not sure. I didn't read carefully, but I'm sure it's going to be a really good Viz. It's almost every year is a very good set of papers and events. So
yeah, last year was quite successful from what I gather, and the years before as well. So
yeah, absolutely.
Cool. You should do some live reporting again. I mean, I won't
with Robert.
Go. I mean, I can't stand that too often, but but last year was fun. And maybe you should get Robert and I don't know who else will be there, like from good interview partners. I'm sure there will be some.
Yeah, we shouldn't spend too much time without Robert and Andy and Alberto. From time to time, we have
just
to
need
invite
a little dose of that. Alberto, he's writing a new book.
He's
busy
writing
with
a new
book, and it seems to be going along well and looking good so far. So,
yeah, what is that? The truthful art, something like that?
Yeah. First one was the functional art, and now he's all for truthful suddenly, now that, you know, I don't know where he has that from, but...
Looking forward to reading that.
Yeah, it seems really good, and we'll see.
Okay, I think we can wrap it up here, right?
I don't have anything else. I'm happy. Yeah.
So I just want to say to our listeners, if you want to suggest... other guests to us, we are happy to receive suggestions. What else? If you can rate us on iTunes or other aggregators, podcast aggregators.
Yeah. Stitcher maybe too.
Yeah. And sign up to our mailing list. And here
follow
we go.
Follow us on Twitter.
Follow us on Twitter if you're not. Mm-hmm. And so that's all for today.
Yeah. Hear you soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Data Stories is brought to you by Click, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Click Sense, which you can download for free at click.de/datastories. That's QLIK.de/datastories.